Hi, I'm Yudi Bunyamin, and welcome to The Neumann Talk, a podcast where I meet past winners of the Australian Mathematical Society's B.H. Neumann Prize to learn about their journeys through the world of mathematics. Just a few moments after this episode is released, one or maybe two new Neumann winners will be named at the 2021 AustMS meeting. So we felt that it was only fitting that in her final moments as a reigning Neumann winner that we spoke to Vinesha Pieris. Vinesha grew up in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and completed a Bachelor of Science with a special degree in mathematics from the University of Sri Jayawardenepura. Afterwards, she took up a demonstrator position and then a temporary lecturer position in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Sri Jayawardenepura before moving to Melbourne to start her PhD. Vinesha's main area of research lies within the branch of applied mathematics known as optimization. Her work so far integrates optimization techniques with other fields, mainly approximation theory and machine learning. Vinesha won the B.H. Neumann Prize in 2020 as a PhD student at the Swinburne University of Technology, working under the supervision of Nadia Sukorukova, Julian Ugon, and Vera Roshina. Vinesha, what do you remember of your Neumann talk?
Well, I guess it was my first AustMS meeting, even though I was a second year PhD student at that time already. And I unfortunately missed my first year AustMS meeting. So everything was online. So at the beginning of 2020, all the seminars, the workshops, everything was supposed to move online. So AustMS was held online. But at the same time, it was not my first online presentation. I actually got the chance to present at some online conferences, seminar series before AustMS. So I guess I was quite experienced presenting online. And because it was held online, I actually didn't get the chance to talk to other students. So I was not so much resourceful about the B.H. Neumann Prize. I knew that there is a huge prize attached to the best student talk, but other than that, I actually had no idea how big it is. So I guess I presented at the special session for optimization, and my talk was about the linear inequality method and its extension. So let me actually break things down to you. So I am working in the area of rational approximation. So rational functions are, you know, the classical ones where you have a ratio of two polynomials. But in the case of the generalized rational function, you actually have a ratio of two linear functions. And there is this special property attached to it, which is quasi-affinity or quasi-linearity. So if you have a ratio of two functions, and these two functions are linear, then this ratio forms a quasi-affine function. So the rational approximation problem then forms a quasi-convex function. Then you can use quasi-convex optimization techniques to tackle these problems. So we actually figured out that the bisection method originally developed for quasi-convex optimization can actually be used to find the optimum rational approximation. So that is actually what we are doing right now. So this linear inequality method, it was developed long time ago in 1964, and it is actually developed to find the rational and generalized rational approximations. But we actually figured out this very old, decades-old linear inequality method is actually equivalent to the application of bisection method for rational approximations. So my talk was basically about these two methods and a nice comparison, and these two methods are actually identical and nobody realized it for so long. So my talk was actually about the identical behaviors between these two methods. And I guess I actually presented in the optimization session. And few hours later, I actually received an email from Masood. And he said, "Hi, Vinesha, congratulations. You have won this award." And it was actually too good to be true. And I actually thought maybe I am sharing the prize with someone else, like you and Frank shared the prize last year, right?
Yeah.
So I thought maybe I'm sharing the prize with someone else, and it was unbelievable. And when I went to the award ceremony, which was again held online, and Masood said, he announced the honorable mentions first, and then he said, "We have one winner this year." And then only I realized, oh, I'm the sole winner this year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess because everything was held online, maybe it was not as much as exciting for, you know, how it actually went for you guys. But to me, it was really exciting and unbelievable. Yeah, I actually did not expect to win the prize, or I did not really prepared for an award-winning talk. I simply wanted to deliver a good talk and, you know, get some good feedback. And I guess I received the best feedback that a student can get.
For the audience, Vinesha is the first Neumann winner who had to deliver the talk online. Due to COVID-19, the conference went online for the first time. And yeah, that's one thing I felt for you, was that you didn't get to experience what every other Neumann winner got to experience. I guess it makes you special as well. You got to experience something different. There's a sense of, you know, when you're at a conference dinner and you get that surprise, because I guess you got to find out early.
Yes.
For the award. I guess they wanted to make sure you showed up to the award ceremony.
Yeah, I guess they actually wanted to ask for a picture of mine. So Masood actually asked me if I want to show a picture of mine at the award ceremony, so everybody gets to at least see a picture of me.
Yeah, and of course, I remember that well, because you are my immediate successor. You are the immediate successor of Trang and myself. It was very exciting for us too. So I know you've already mentioned you're very surprised about this, and you didn't necessarily prepare a talk to win the prize. But I have to ask, why do you think you won?
Well, I actually guess probably because my topic was very interesting, because we actually tried to show the audience that a very old method is identical to some very new technique that was very recently discovered. And at the same time, my presentation was full of pictures. I am actually using so many pictures in my presentations, and just to, you know, make sure that audience doesn't always think about, you know, theories and lemmas and everything. So they get the chance to see pictures which are interesting. And at the same time, I always try to follow my supervisor's advice, which is trying to talk a bit slower than you usually do. So she always tells me, "Vinesha, you have to talk a bit slower than you usually do when you are presenting online, because there will be some delays, and, you know, even your audience is full of mathematicians. Your expertise may not be their expertise. So they actually need some time to think and digest what you are saying." So I guess those techniques actually led me to win this prize.
That's very interesting. You mentioned the piece of advice that's very specific to online talks. How do you think giving a maths research talk is different online?
Well, presenting online is hard, but I guess it's not so different from the face-to-face presentation. So when you are presenting online, I guess you actually cannot see your audience. You cannot get the energy in the room, and your audience do not get to see your body languages. They will not catch your hand gestures. They only, you know, get to see the top half of you in a very tiny version. So your hand gestures are not going to work. So the only thing that you can control is your voice. So you have to control it. And I guess when you are presenting a mathematical talk, it doesn't matter if you are presenting online or face-to-face. You always have to keep in mind that you are trying to explain very mathematical stuff to a very mathematical audience, right? So in most cases, your audience will be full of mathematicians. But I guess my first recommendation is to talk a bit slower and try to incorporate some interesting things like pictures and videos to your presentation. So it will make your presentation a bit interesting. And especially when you are doing an online presentation, so you have to keep the attention of your audience to yourself because many people are staying home and there are many distractions. So you have to make sure that you are keeping the attention of your audience to yourself.
Yeah, I'm sure people, you know, minding the kids or, you know, the dog is running around the house or something like that. Yeah, I know what you mean. So, like we mentioned earlier, that was the first time AustMS was online. I wanted to ask you more about what the experience of just being at the conference was like. Obviously, a big part of going to conferences is the social aspect. One of the things I liked about AustMS is it's that one time of year where we meet all of the mathematicians in Australia. How was that for you? How was the social aspect of the conference for you, considering that it was online?
Well, like I mentioned, I actually didn't get the chance to meet other students. And it was very sad, actually, because obviously if I meet you or Tran, I would have grabbed some more advices from you guys. So I guess that is actually the sad part of having online conferences, because you do not get the chance to talk to other students and you do not get the chance to talk to other more experienced people in your area. But I guess within the optimization community, we actually have weekly seminar series going on. So we kind of know each other very well. So probably people working in optimization, they actually know me. Probably they don't know me as a PhD student. They probably think that I'm actually a graduate. So the socialization part was not, I don't know, maybe not so prominent last year. And I actually miss socializing with other students. And well, I guess even if you do not get the chance to see each other face to face, you still can engage with people online. So there are, you know, seminar series, workshops happening. So specifically for PhD students, I guess it's really important to socialize and, you know, try to network with other people. So opportunities will come to you if you know more people working in your area. So I actually miss socializing with people and, you know, getting experts' ideas about your research and everything about socialization.
You mentioned that people didn't know that you were a student. I found that a lot of people only found out that I was a student when I won the Norman Prize.
Yeah.
So at the time that we're doing this interview, it's sort of quite close to the AustMS meeting, actually. I want to know what's happened since you won the prize. Were there any opportunities that came up, or has the prize sort of affected maybe the way you do research or the way that you give talks? And what's happened since you won?
Well, I guess it actually improved my confidence, of course. But then right after AustMS, I presented at ANSIAM conference and I was not feeling confident at all, because I actually thought I should probably deliver a very good talk this time. Otherwise, they will think, oh, this girl does not deserve the prize. So yeah. It was very hard and it was very nervous. But I actually guess I think I did okay. And my supervisor received emails from some people who came to my talk from Swinburne. So she said some people sent her email saying Vinesha's talk was good. So, yeah. So I guess it's actually affecting you in a way where you always think that you have to deliver a good talk, but it's probably not the case. You just have to, you know, go with the flow and just do your regular presentations. In terms of opportunities, I actually cannot think of any opportunities that came up after the talk, because you know, I guess everything was online and many people did not probably get the chance to come to the award ceremony last year at OSTMS. So, of course, many people know me now, but I guess they actually knew me even before I win the prize, because within the optimization community, I am a very active member. I'm giving talks at, you know, seminar series and conferences. So, yeah.
Yeah, my experience was that the main benefit is suddenly people know who you are. And then sometimes, you know, the big name professor that you think doesn't know who you are will say hi to you and know your name. And yeah, I guess it's really, it helps you feel like you are part of the community.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully the opportunities will come, you know, when the world goes back to normal.
Yeah.
I guess that's something I notice a lot of Norm winners have experienced, is that pressure afterwards. The next OSTMS meeting is coming up, and I see that you have a talk lined up. How do you feel going into that?
To be honest, I am actually trying to think about the next OSTMS presentation as just a regular presentation, because I won the award once. I don't want to win the award twice.
Why not?
Well, if I deserve the second award, then of course it will come to me. But again, I am actually not trying to deliver another talk which can win this award. So I'm trying to just impress my audience and get some good feedbacks and, you know, suggestions from the audience. So that is my target. And of course, again, I have this huge burden kind of thing attached to me. So I think I have to deliver a good talk this year as well.
Yeah, I tell myself that every day.
Yeah. But then if you think about, you know, delivering a good talk all the time, then you will probably not deliver a good talk. So
yeah,
you just have to relax and present as you usually do.
Vinesha, so I understand that you grew up in Sri Lanka. I should start by asking, what were you like as a child?
Well, I was just a regular child, I guess. But I did not really imagine myself doing a PhD or at least doing a bachelor degree in mathematics. I did not really thought of doing anything when I was a kid. I always wanted to become a doctor. But at some point, I realized, oh, I cannot look at blood, so probably I should ditch this idea of being a doctor. But at the same time, I actually knew that I'm good at mathematics. I was really good with handling logic and numbers and everything. So I wanted to always do something in mathematics, but not particularly, you know, optimization or mathematics PhD itself. Yeah.
How did you know that you were good in mathematics? So what were the signs that made you think that you were good at mathematics?
Well, probably the end semester examinations at school. So the education system in Sri Lanka is a bit different than what we have here in Australia. So I will tell you about the system a bit later. So every year we have prize giving ceremonies, and if you manage to get the highest score for some subjects, you will be able to get a prize and a nice certificate at the prize giving ceremonies. So when I was, I don't know, maybe 11 years old or 10 years old, I actually started winning the prize for mathematics. So for so many years, I actually won the prize. So that is actually when I realized, oh, maybe I'm actually good at mathematics. And I actually kept on doing that. And then I guess the education system in Sri Lanka actually pushed me to the place that I am today, probably. So let me actually tell you a bit about the system. So the education system is free. I would say mostly free. So it's free. So, and at the same time, it is really very competitive in Sri Lanka. So the first hurdle that you have to Basically, FACE is known as the ordinary level examination. And you have to follow 9 subjects and pass the 9 subjects so you can continue your education. So you have to basically pass mathematics, Sinhalese language, and your religion, whatever your religion is. You have to pass these 3 subjects. If you fail one of these 3 subjects, then you cannot actually continue your education, or you have to probably look at some other things that you should do after this ordinary level examination. So it has always been a very critical subject for everyone. So mathematics is very hard for most students, but at the same time, you have to pass mathematics so you can continue your education. So when you finish your ordinary level examination, based on your merits and probably based on the available resources at each school, you will be selected to one main stream. So when I was doing ordinary level examination, we had combined mathematics, bioscience, I guess business studies and arts as the main subjects that you can select to continue your studies. So you have to continue one of these 4 streams for the next 2.5 years. Then you have to face advanced level examination. So I selected combined mathematics. It is not just mathematics. So you basically have 50% pure math, 50% applied math. So that is what this combined mathematics subject is all about. And other than mathematics, you have to follow chemistry and physics as well. And then based on your advanced level examination results, you will be selected to a government university. And these government universities are free, so you get the chance to get a degree for free if you get selected to a government university. So it is really very competitive. And in a way, you don't get the independency to select what you want to do. So government will probably select you to a good university and to a good degree, but you probably do not get the chance to select it for yourself in most cases. So I guess that is how the system works, and the system actually pushed me to be who I am today.
That's quite fascinating, because these days we hear a lot about high school students going, oh, I don't know what to choose, you know, I don't know what to do in university. You know, it seems like we have so much choice that we don't know what to do. But I guess it's very different in Sri Lanka. Did you want to do an undergraduate degree in mathematics? So you did your undergraduate degree in mathematics in Sri Lanka, right?
Yes. So this is how university works. So for the first 2 years, you have to follow a subject combination. So there are some, you know, predefined subject combinations that you can select and do. And of course, you cannot do whatever you want. They will select the combination that you deserve based on your advanced level examination results and also based on your preference. So we basically have to tell them, okay, I like this subject combination. And then if I do not get selected to this combination, then I would like to try this combination and so on. So they will probably check their available resources and then tell you what combination that you should follow. So I get the chance to follow statistics, mathematics, and chemistry. So yes, chemistry was there, and I was not good at chemistry, but mathematics and statistics were okay for me, I guess. So when you finish your first 2 years following this combination, then based on your results, the university will tell you if you can pursue a special degree. So special degrees, so I guess the standard of the special degree is very similar to the standard of honors degree. So when you finish your first 2 years, I actually wanted to get selected to a statistics special degree because I was very fascinated by the idea of becoming an actuarist at that time. But unfortunately, I did not get selected to the special statistic degree. Instead, I got selected to the mathematics special degree. So again, it was not my choice. But at the same time, I guess it actually pushed me in the right direction, right? So that is how I actually ended up doing a special degree in mathematics. So in Sri Lanka, even though the system is very different and you don't have much of a choice to select what degree you want to do, I guess they are actually directing you in the right direction, because for some students, just like me, I actually didn't know what to do when I got selected to the university, and they gave me a choice of doing three subjects and then specializing in one subject. So that is how I actually became a mathematician.
So what I'm always interested in, especially the people who come from different parts of the world, was how did the people around you feel about your going into mathematics?
Well, my parents, they probably did not have any idea what I wanted to do. And I actually had no idea what I wanted to do. I was just going with the flow. And I guess they never actually forced me to do anything specifically. So when I tell them I want to do mathematics for my advanced level examination, they said, yeah, okay, if you feel like doing mathematics comfortably for your next examination, yeah, that's okay, let's do this. And when I got selected to the university, they actually probably did not know what subjects I was doing. Even when they asked me what I'm doing, I always say, oh, I'm doing mathematics, that's it. Because the more I give them, the more they will be confused about everything. So I always tell them I do mathematics. So they did not really forced me or pressured me about my education or anything at all. And I guess my mom always told me to do whatever I feel like comfortable doing. So when I told her that I want to do a PhD in mathematics, she actually asked me, can you do it in Sri Lanka? And I told her, no, I cannot do it in Sri Lanka. I have to go abroad, probably to another country. And she said, can you actually handle yourself? I mean, staying in another country and being yourself, like you'll be alone for so many years. And I was quite okay with, you know, being alone. Well, to be honest, I'm not alone. I have a lot of friends here living in Melbourne. And we actually did bachelor's together. So we spent a few years together, and now we are living in Melbourne together. So I guess people around me, specifically my parents, they actually let me do whatever I feel like doing comfortably.
Earlier you mentioned that if you want to do a PhD, you can't do it in Sri Lanka. I think some people don't quite understand why we have to travel to do maths. I think some people think, don't you just need pen and paper? Can't you just do that anywhere in the world? So why can't you do your PhD in Sri Lanka?
Well, as far as I know, there are no PhD programs in Sri Lanka, in any university in Sri Lanka. And as far as I know, there is just one person from my Department of Mathematics from the University of Sri Jayawardenepura, where I actually did my bachelor's. There is this one person who has a PhD in Sri Lanka. So I talked to him about it. And he said, the PhD is not actually received from a Sri Lankan university. It was a joint project between Sri Lanka and India. So he got the chance to get a PhD from Sri Lanka. For some reason, I actually don't know. But other than that, I do not actually know anyone who received a PhD from Sri Lanka. So there are no any PhD programs for specifically for mathematics students. And I know there are some chemistry PhD programs, which are very good. But for mathematicians and probably for statisticians, there are no PhD programs that we can follow. So you necessarily have to move to another country and start doing a PhD in another country.
Is there a reason behind that? Is there a reason why there are no PhD programs for maths in Sri Lanka?
I have no idea.
Because I guess we take it for granted here that you can just go and do a PhD almost at any university you can think of. But I guess that also meant that, like you mentioned, there were not that many role models, right? Like there were not that many people you met who had PhDs that they obtained in Sri Lanka. So what pushed you to do a PhD? Or what gave you the idea to do a PhD?
Okay, so another interesting story here. So when I finished my bachelor's degree, again, I had no idea what I should do next. And at the same time, the mathematics department where I did my bachelor's degree, they hired us as demonstrators. So the responsibilities of demonstrators are basically the same as the responsibilities of tutors here. So we basically conduct tutorial classes and lab sessions, and we also have to mark the assignments of students, probably first year and second year students' assignments. And few months after they recruited us as demonstrator, they actually offered me a temporary lecturer position at the same department. So I got the chance to work with first year undergraduate students. I guess I taught two courses, one course for mathematics students about how they can use Maple software, and the other course was for bioscience students. And it was really very interesting because bioscience students, they do know how to do basic mathematics stuff like arithmetics and everything. But when I come up with some new, maybe terminology, they actually confuse themselves. They do not remember what they did for their, I don't know, maybe for ordinary level examination. So long time ago, they did mathematics. They do not remember all the things that they learned. So it was very interesting for me to dig a little bit deeper and try to come up with some interesting strategies to approach them. So when I was working as a temporary lecturer, I actually realized, okay, this is what I should do. I should probably start teaching students. So if I want to have a career in teaching, I should probably go and do a PhD. To be honest, that is what actually motivated me to come to Australia and do a PhD in mathematics.
I think what's a bit unexpected in why you wanted to do a PhD is that it was because of teaching, not really because of research. And to explain to the audience that in some developing countries, including, say, in Indonesia, where I'm from, it's common to have lecturers at the university who don't have PhDs. That seems like a very rare thing in Australia now. Okay, so of all places in the world, why Australia? How did you end up here? And why specifically in Swinburne, I guess?
Okay, so I guess many Sri Lankans are traveling to USA and Canada to do PhDs. But for some reason, I actually didn't want to travel to USA or to Canada because their PhD programs come with a master's degree attached. So you basically have to spend 5 years doing a master's degree and then do your PhD. So in Australia, it's just 3 years. You can get a PhD in 3 years and you get to work with some good researchers in your area. So when I was doing my bachelor's degree, we were mostly, I don't know, at least I felt like we were mostly focusing on pure mathematical stuff. So, you know, linear algebra, abstract algebra, group theory, ring theory, field theory, module theory. We learned all sort of stuff, but we also get the chance to learn optimization and probably some other applied mathematical courses, probably fluid dynamics, mathematical side of fluid dynamics or something like that. So optimization actually caught my heart. So because it's very applicable, we actually use optimization in our day-to-day life without even knowing it, right? So I actually wanted to do something in optimization. So I started looking at the profiles of the potential supervisors. And for some reason, I actually liked Melbourne. For some reason, I actually don't know. So I started looking at the profiles of potential supervisors from Melbourne. And then I sent some emails to the supervisors asking if they have any, you know, good projects and if they would like to supervise me for a PhD project. But to be honest, I actually did not receive feedbacks or any reply from many supervisors. But Nadia from Swinburne University, she actually replied me and she wanted to know a bit more about myself and the research that I conducted while I am in Sri Lanka. So I basically worked in homological algebra, which is very abstract again, but I actually wanted to translate from homological algebra to optimization, so pure maths to applied maths, because I personally liked applied mathematical stuff, specifically optimization. So Nadia somehow agreed to work with me and she invited me to come and do a PhD with her. She had a nice project going on at that moment, so she wanted to take me as a team member. So that is how I actually ended up in Australia, I guess. So again, as international students, we actually do not have much opportunities to go to another country and do a PhD specifically in Australia, because you have to find a potential supervisor first before you apply to any university, right? So it's a really hard and time-consuming procedure, but somehow I am so grateful for Nadia. So she actually agreed to invite me to do a PhD here in Australia. So that is how I actually ended up in Australia. So I actually don't have a particular reason for selecting Swinburne. It is probably because Nadia is from Swinburne.
So what are you thinking of doing after the PhD?
That's actually a good question. So like I said, along this journey, I actually had no clear idea of what I want to do next. When I finished my bachelor's degree, I actually didn't have any idea what should I do next. But in some sense, everything actually came to me eventually. The demonstratorship and then the temporary lecturer position, they all came to me. So I guess something will probably come to me when I finish my PhD, and my submission is very close. I have to submit my thesis by probably mid-February next year, I guess. So I really would like to do a postdoctorate here in Australia, because there are so many research going on in the area of optimization. So I don't really want to stick with just one side of optimization. So I just really want to broaden my network and my knowledge on optimization. So I will probably try to find a good postdoctorate in optimization first. And then after finishing the postdoctorate, I will probably see what I can do next.
Do you feel like you want to come back to Sri Lanka one day?
I'm not 100% sure, because doing research in Sri Lanka is very different from what we do here in Australia, because in Sri Lanka, we have a teacher-centered education system. So the lecturers are probably doing so much work towards teaching and education. So you do not probably get so much time to do research by yourself. And I would say there are not so many researchers working in the side of optimization. So I guess if I stay here in Australia, I will probably get the chance to work a bit more on optimization and probably meet some, you know, giant academicians from optimization, and will probably get the chance to work with them. So I guess in some sense, living in Australia is probably beneficial if you are doing research in optimization.
Yeah, I think not many people know that in developing countries, the universities don't tend to be research focused. In mathematics in particular, do you think that's something that needs to change in Sri Lanka? What impact do you think that's having on mathematics in Sri Lanka, or the relationship that Sri Lankans have with mathematics?
Well, to be honest, there's probably a very handful of people are interested in doing mathematics, at least for their bachelor's degree. So for an example, at my university, University of Sri Javadhanapura, we probably had like 250 students for the first 2 years who did mathematics, and they only selected 13 students for the special degree. So it is really very competitive. And many people do not get selected to the special degrees, even though you wanted to do a specialization, specifically in mathematics. So I guess if we can, well, it is not really easy to change the system, right? So you have a huge number of students that you should teach, and at the same time, you cannot really focus on each one of them. And only if you get selected to a special degree, then the lecturers will get to know you a bit more, and then only they can focus on you and your research. But again, there's not so much time that they can allocate for research. So I guess the first thing that should change in Sri Lanka in terms of research in mathematics is that the whole system should change. But it's really not easy. And I guess it's not restricted to mathematics in almost all areas, probably other than computer science, because they really do very good research. And I personally know that the computer science department at University of Srijayavardhanapura winning global awards for many, many projects that they actually conduct there. So I guess, again, there will be very huge steps that we should take if we have to broaden the research area related to mathematics, but it will probably take so much time to get to the point where we do research in mathematics at the level of what we are doing here in Australia.
Early on, Vinesha, you said that optimization is something that you can use in your daily life. I feel like optimization is a word where if you just say it to a random person on the street who doesn't have a mathematical background, it means something to them. Whereas some other areas of maths, if you tell them the name of the area, either it doesn't mean something to them or it means the completely wrong thing. What I'm curious to know is, since you've delved deeper into optimization, do you find that some of the things you do in your daily life in a non-mathematical context, you've done certain things differently since you've become more of an optimizer?
Well, in some cases, yes, because we are actually using optimization without even realizing it. So for an example, suppose you want to come back home from work and you probably need to use the shortest path, and you probably need to minimize the amount of time that you are spending on the road. You probably need to avoid all the traffic and everything. So you are using optimization without even knowing that you are using optimization. And in some cases, I actually think that I would have done something very differently if I use optimization. But I cannot actually think of a very particular, you know, example to tell you at the moment. But yes, I do really think that things can work out in a different way if you think about some questions from the point of view of optimization.
But is that always a good thing, do you think? That people who do mathematics at a deeper level, is it always a good thing that it subconsciously creeps into our daily life?
Well, I guess it's actually a good thing. But in some cases, if you think too hard and try to apply your very deep mathematical concepts to your daily life, it will probably not go so well. So you basically have to be very careful when you are using mathematics in your daily life. But you will be able to get some very nice beneficials by using deeper mathematics.
Yes, thinking too much sometimes is not so good. So I want to get to know a bit more about your research. And the way we ask this to all of our guests is, if I, so not you, but if I'm at the pub and I speak to a random person at the pub and they ask me, what does Vinesha do? What's her research about? What do you want me to tell them?
Okay, so you can always tell them that Vinesha is working in the area of optimization. So optimization is basically about minimizing or maximizing some quantity subjected to some set of constraints. And you can also say that Vinesha particularly likes to look at approximation problems from the point of view of optimization. So approximation theory and optimization, they actually go together all the time. So many approximation problems can be reformulated as optimization problems, and you can solve them by using optimization techniques. So approximation theory and optimization, they actually go together all the time. So you can say that Vinesha likes to look at approximation problems from the point of view of optimization. And in particular, she works in the area of rational approximation. So when you are given a continuous function, and if you want to approximate this continuous function using a rational function, Vinesha will help you to approximate this function. Yeah.
Yeah, you know who to find if you need that. During my PhD, I've had the opportunity to learn a bit of optimization. Having been exposed to it a bit more, when I think of optimization, I think of it as a very like theorem proof kind of area, actually. But approximation, you know, it sounds like it's not very exact, you know, like when you say approximation, it doesn't sound as rigorous. First of all, is that the way you see it? And if so, how do the two go together? How do those two things that seem like they're very different in nature go together?
Well, as I said, many approximation problems actually can be reformulated as optimization problems. So that is what we actually do. So we take the rational approximation problem where your approximation is in the form of a ratio of two functions. So you take this problem and we are actually working in the uniform norm. So you are trying to minimize the worst error or the maximum deviation of your approximation from the original function. So you minimize this worst error, and at the same time, you are trying to approximate the original function by a ratio of two functions, a rational function. So we take the rational approximation problem and we reformulate it in a way that we can see it as an optimization problem. So this optimization theory and approximation theory, they always go together. I guess many approximation problems, even very old ones like the polynomial approximation, the piecewise polynomial approximation, they all can be reformulated as optimization problems. And these optimization problems are convex problems. So I guess from very old time, so people actually realize that approximation and optimization goes together, and they try to reformulate the approximation problems in terms of optimization. So you are probably thinking why we take rational approximation, right? So we take an approximation problem and try to formulate it in a different way using optimization techniques. At the same time, why did we take a rational function as the approximation? So what really happened here is that, so you have polynomial functions. Polynomials are simple and easy to handle. And the corresponding optimization problem is a convex problem. You can solve it by using convex optimization techniques. Again, approximation theory and optimization theory, again, you know, collaborate with each other in this case. But if you need to approximate a non-smooth or a non-Lipschitz function, then polynomial approximations are not very efficient. You probably need a higher degree polynomial and they're not very stable. So one way to overcome this is to use a piecewise polynomial approximation. Again, the problem will be convex if you know the location of the points where one polynomial changes to another. So these points are usually known as knots. If you know the location of these knots, so if you reformulate your approximation problem as an optimization problem, again, you have a convex optimization problem. You can use convex optimization techniques to solve this. But if you don't know the location of these knots, then the problem becomes non-convex and it is very hard to solve. And at the same time, it is actually known as a very important but yet open problem in approximation theory. So rational approximation actually comes to play as a promising alternative to free knot piecewise linear functions, the approximations. So I guess there are some techniques developed for rational approximations in particular. from the point of view of approximation, but they do not compute the optimum approximation. They only compute a near optimal approximation. So what we are doing is we are trying to look at this approximation problem from the point of view of optimization so we can find an optimum solution. So for approximation people, so people who are working in the approximation theory, they probably do not care about the optimum approximation. They only need something very close to the optimum one and, you know, very easy to handle and all sort of things. But for us as optimizers, we actually need the optimum solution. We either need the maximum or the minimum function or the solution, right? So we actually thought, why not look at this problem from the point of view of optimization and try to find the optimum approximation as a rational function. So that is how actually optimization and approximation theory works together. I think they actually worked together very well since 80s, probably mid 80s. So since then, they are still working together. And we also thought, why not try to work and, you know, get these two areas again back together?
Because sometimes I wonder, when we do approximations, is it really that important to have the most optimal solution? I think some people have the impression that with approximation theory, you decide a point where it's good enough, right? And then it doesn't matter anymore. Why is it so important to actually find that optimal optimization, especially if you think about like real world applications, for example?
Well, suppose you actually have a numerical procedure where you have to find the optimum solution. So if finding the approximation is part of a huge numerical procedure, you of course want the optimum solution. Otherwise, your procedure will not probably be able to run the way that you want it to run, right? So in some cases, you probably really need to find the optimum approximation so that the other components of your numerical procedure will work the way that you want them to work. So in other cases, in probably most applications in the area of approximation, people only need a good enough approximation. They do not really need the optimum one. But I guess in some particular cases, specifically if you have a huge numerical procedure which includes finding an approximation, and if this approximation is not optimal, your whole procedure will probably not work. So in some applications, of course, you need to find the optimum approximation. But in some cases, you can actually be satisfied with the near optimal solution. So it actually depends on the application that you are working on, or at least the numerical procedure you have.
So when we were looking at your publication so far, another thing that seems to pop up is that you also work in optimization and applying it to more data science-y things like deep learning. And how do those interact? Because I think some people think of deep learning or machine learning stuff as being not as rigorous as other areas of math. How do those interact?
Well, I guess they actually interact naturally. But the thing is that many people do not know that they do interact with each other. So basically, deep learning is actually a subsection of machine learning, which actually includes neural networks, right? So for many computer science people, they use neural networks in their daily lives and, you know, their research, but they do not really think about what's happening inside this neural network. They really refer to this mathematics as a black box. So we actually wanted to see what's happening inside this black box, because we actually knew that optimization is going on probably inside this black box. So when I first started using deep learning techniques in my research, I even considered these optimization techniques as a black box. So I simply used the inbuilt commands in Python and, you know, did all my calculations, and I worked on some classification problems and all. But then later on, I actually followed the course offered by AMSI AC Network. They do have some undergraduate and postgraduate courses every semester for mathematical students. So I followed one of their courses, which was optimization for deep learning. Then I actually realized, okay, so optimization is happening inside this neural network and nobody really tried to really learn what's happening inside here. So we actually looked into it. So in a neural network, you are trying to somehow minimize your error. And most widely used error is the least squares. So we are working in uniform norm. We try to minimize the maximum deviation or the worst error in your approximation, right? So we thought, why not try to replace this error by a uniform approximation based error? So we actually replaced it. And then later on, I wanted to incorporate rational functions because I am working in the area of rational approximation. So we tried to incorporate rational functions, and we actually did some very nice research. But at the same time, we are still inside the area of optimization. So if you look at our papers, you will probably notice that many keywords are related to optimization than to deep learning. So we are approaching deep learning. We are trying to stay within the framework of deep learning, but at the same time, we are trying to tackle everything from the point of view of optimization. So still within the optimization, and these interactions are very natural, and we are actually trying to look at deep learning problems from the point of view of optimization. So that is how we actually deal with these interactions, trying to stay within the area of optimization and try to look at the deep learning problems with probably a new eye from the point of view of optimization.
That's very interesting. When I think of an optimization problem, I think there's some real world problem where someone wants to optimize something and then the mathematician comes along and, you know, does the maths and tries to optimize it. But the sense that I'm getting here is that what you're doing is you're looking at almost like a natural phenomenon that is somehow very naturally optimized, like is naturally optimizing itself, and going in there and trying to understand how or why it does that. Is that a good way to think about these kind of projects that you're working on?
Well, I guess that is 100% correct. So we do not really get the chance to find real world applications sometimes. So we found our applications in the area of deep learning. So they are actually real world applications in some sense. So I remember in my first paper, we actually used deep learning techniques to distinguish two types of EEG signals. So for medical doctors, it is very hard for them to sometimes distinguish between two classes of EEG signals. So if you can develop an automated system to distinguish these two signals, it would be really very beneficial for them. So in some sense, they are still real-world applications, but you are actually trying to look at this problem mathematically. So I guess for me, I was really curious about what's happening inside a neural network because people used to call it a black box. So when I realized that it's just optimization happening there and they are really trying to minimize the error, it actually fascinated me. I was really fascinated by what's happening inside the neural network because they are trying to mimic the human brain. So how we, you know, distinguish between two things, they are trying to mimic this one. And at the same time, it is just optimization. So they are actually using optimization techniques to tackle this problem. So I guess it was easy for us to look at this problem since we worked in the area of optimization. And like you said, it's actually naturally occurred and we wanted to investigate it a bit further and see what's happening inside. And I guess in a way, it is easy to take some, you know, natural phenomena and try to investigate what's happening there and try to apply the optimization techniques there than applying optimization techniques to a very real world kind of an application.
What are you hoping comes out of this? Because like you said, these things like neural networks, for example, they seem to work, you know, and people who use them without necessarily understanding what's going on. So what are you hoping comes out of your research where you try to understand this better?
Well, neural networks itself actually works much better. So we are actually trying to find some specific cases where we can use or replace this error by uniform error. So for us, when we actually replace the error by a uniform error where we try to minimize the maximum error, it's actually not new. People used it, but they did not want to investigate it a bit further. So we actually took our chances and we investigated it, and we actually figured out that uniform error works much better when your training data set is either very small and reliable, or if you have some imbalanced classes. So suppose you have two classes in your data set and one class is relatively smaller than the other class. So in those two cases, then it's very beneficial to use uniform error than the standard, you know, neural network framework. So I guess what we are trying to do here is that try to investigate a bit further so we can come up with some specific scenarios where we can use a uniform norm and rational approximation to get better maybe classification accuracy results if we are working in the area of classification problems. So if we work on very specific scenarios, people do not have to, you know, spend so much time finding what's best for them. So if they have a very small data set, they know what to use, they know how to replace the error, and we have actually helped them to do that, right? So in some sense, I guess that is what actually we are trying to achieve here.
So very fascinating. It's a different perspective on optimization. It's a very different one from what people normally think about. Yeah. So I want to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests at the end of the episode, which is to complete the sentence, a mathematician is someone who?
Well, I guess to me, a mathematician is someone who brings all the other research areas together. So for an example, I'm working in optimization, but my applications are mostly in the area of deep learning, right? So for another example, engineers need math. Physicists, they need math. I actually cannot think of any research area that do not use mathematics. So I guess if us mathematicians do not work on the development of these mathematical techniques and concepts, there will probably be no developments happening in any other area. So I guess my answer to your question is, a mathematician is someone who brings all the other research areas together.
Many thanks to Vinesha for talking to us for this episode. And as she passes on the title to the next winners, we wish her the very best in all her future endeavors. To find out more about Vinesha, visit her LinkedIn profile linked in the show notes. This episode was produced by Julian Garrett and myself. We'll be back in January with another episode. Neumann Talk is a podcast produced by students and staff from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at UNSW Sydney and hosted by me, Yudi Bunyamin. Follow UNSW Maths and Stats on Facebook or Instagram to see updates on the latest episodes as well as other exciting news from our school. If you've been listening to our podcast, then we'd love to hear from you. Send me a tweet or a message on Twitter at @Yudi_Bunyamin. Let us know who you are and if there's something one of the winners talked about that really resonated with you, or even if you have any questions about mathematics of your own.